Vegas, baby, Vegas!
At the end of the game, you count up your money. That's how you find out who's best.
If all my bets were safe, there just wouldn't be any juice.
The point spreads, the prop bets, the teasers, the parlays. From Vegas to you, this is Behind the Bets.
Welcome back to another episode of Behind the Bets with Doug Kazarian, presented by DraftKings, America's top-rated sportsbook app. And look, it's always busy in September with football beginning, but we have bubble life in both the NHL and NBA. And a busy weekend in the non-traditional sports like horse racing, the Kentucky Derby, the Run for the Roses is this Saturday. Christina, are you prepared? Can you handle all these things going on?
There is a lot going on, but it's got to be the most exciting weekend. You've got all these things going on, you know, horse racing, everything.
And lots of opportunity to make some money, and hopefully we do just that coming up on the pod. So here's what's coming up. I'll start with next week. Next week, we are taping an NFL season preview. So we're going to try to get a multitude of guests, have some futures plays, some player prop futures plays, and some maybe week one analysis as well. Daily Wager returns in the usual time slot, 6 Eastern, ESPN 2, but it'll be from Las Vegas, as we announced last week. So I'm excited for that. That begins Tuesday, right after the Labor Day holiday. So a lot of stuff going on for next week. As for this podcast, The Hammer, Hank Greenberg, with his breakdown of the Kentucky Derby, we have Tis the Law and Odds on Favorites, so less than even money. And Hank's going to tell you how to approach betting that, maybe make some money, not just try to risk a lot, but a little with a straight wager. We're going to have the UFC guys. Lou and Matthew are here after a stellar weekend last weekend, so we did well on that front. And they're going to wrap things up. And then, but getting us with the leadoff is going to be Wes Reynolds going into the FedEx. All the money up for grabs. So Wes coming up momentarily, then it's Hank, and then it's Matthew and Lou to finish things off. But before we get into today's episode, I want to remind everyone, professional football is just days away. Most of us are drafting our fantasy football teams. Make sure you're staying up to date on all your fantasy football news with ESPN fantasy experts Matthew Perry, Field Yates, Stefania Bell, Mike Clay, and Daniel Dopp on the Fantasy Focus Football Podcast. You'll get daily strategy previews and injury reports to ensure you have all the information you'll need for your fantasy football team. Be sure to download and subscribe to Fantasy Focus Football and Behind the Bets on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Stop. Hammer time.
Okay, let's talk a little golf now. Wes Reynolds has been on a heater all summer. Did not have John Rahm, did not have Dustin Johnson like the previous week, but it was an epic finish. And, you know, it's crazy. Twitter is often terrible, but it's awesome in situations like this. It's the authentic reaction of everyone when DJ hit the big bomb putt, and then Rahm, it's that old McDonald's commercial, and you'll like this being the Indiana native that you are, with Magic and Bird. It's like off the rafters, off the scoreboard, nothing but
right. Yeah, absolutely. You don't often get, Doug, the number one and the number two player in the world heads up in anything, let alone a playoff. First time this has happened since 1995, the World Series of Golf, when Greg Norman was number one and Nick Price was number two, and they battled in a playoff. And that's what you had with number one DJ and number two Rahm, with Rahm coming out on top.
So it just sets up for more drama in this final week and final tournament of the FedEx. And it kind of reminds me of what we saw in the NBA All-Star game, which I believe they brought over from the Big Three, like an Elam ending in the fourth quarter where they stagger points. And I always said fantasy football should do this in the playoffs, right? The one versus the four seed or whatever format you have. I know you get, in theory, an inferior opponent in fantasy football, but it's so random, some of the scheduling during the season, that sometimes it's not inferior opponent. Some leagues let you pick your opponent. But I think there should be kind of like a 6-point head start in fantasy. But anyway, I digress. It is cool and unique, at least, that how they're doing it. Can you explain to our listeners exactly what that means for this weekend?
Yeah, let me go kind of with the genesis of how the PGA Tour and the FedEx Cup came up with this format. If you recall, 2 years ago in 2018 at the Tour Championship, and everybody flipped over on that Labor Day Monday finish, Tiger Woods won an event on the PGA Tour for the first time in 5 years. So obviously that's the story, with Tiger back in the winner's circle. But he did not win the Tour Championship. That was won by Justin Rose. And they had that awkward moment at the end where Tiger's getting the trophy. Everybody's going crazy. Tiger finally backed up to his winning ways. And then you show Justin Rose next to him. It's like, oh, by the way, yeah, this guy won the FedEx Cup and won $10 million as like an aside note. And look, FedEx pays a lot of money for sponsorship entitlement with the PGA Tour. They want their award and they want their trophy to matter. So, and it was really kind of second rate compared to Tiger's win in 2018. So last year, what they did was they decided to do like a staggered strokes kind of format, taking the top 30 in the FedEx Cup standings. And it worked out last year because Rory McIlroy, I think, started like maybe fifth place at 5 under par, but ended up shooting the lowest score anyway and won the event for me last year, having a 9-1 ticket on him. But here's how they do it. Dustin Johnson, number one in the FedEx Cup points right now. He is going to start this event at 10 under par. John Rahm, number two in the points. He starts 2 strokes back at 8 under par. Justin Thomas is in the number three hole. He starts at 7 under. And then it goes downward from there all the way to the guys that are like 26 to 30th, and they start at even par. So what they want to see happen is they want to see the FedEx Cup winner also win the Tour Championship. So you win the whole thing and the whole $15 million for the winning player. So it worked out last year. It's not foolproof by any stretch of the imagination, but that's what they're endeavoring to try to do. I'm not really in love with the system, but I don't know really what a better alternative would be at this point.
Yeah. And it's cool. Like, try things, they work. Like, I'm not like the old school baseball guy, like the narrative would suggest, but I was definitely against like the new extra innings thing, and now I love it. So try new things, not the end of the world. If it doesn't work, you just keep trying new things, and sometimes it works. Like, I thought that worked in the NBA All-Star game. I think sometimes things like this work. So try it and we'll see what happens. In terms of betting, what are your plays?
Yeah, I'm going to not do what the Hammer did in the Kentucky Derby segment, where he's not going to try to beat Tis the Law, and I'm not going to try to either, but I am going to try to beat the favorites. And I think your hand is a little bit forced if you're betting into that market where the strokes are already allocated, which most of the futures markets are going to have. So look, I don't really want to take Dustin Johnson at 2-1. I don't really want to take John Rahm at only 5-2 with their starting handicap here. So you kind of are forced a little bit to try to see if you can beat those two favorites, but you can't really go too far down the board. So that's kind of the approach I took this week, much like I did last year. So I went with the guy in the four hole, and that would be Webb Simpson, who starts at 6 under par. He's basically around 10-12-1, kind of in that range to win this whole thing. He took last week off from the BMW Championship in Chicago at Olympia Field. And he's not as good of a putter on bent grass as he is on Bermuda, which he's going to get this week down at East Lake Golf Club in Atlanta. So Webb Simpson went with a little bit of strategery, if you will, and said, I'm going to take a shot that I'm not going to drop very much in the standings and that I can make it up. And he only dropped one spot. He was third going into last week. Now he starts fourth. So the gamble could pay off here. And he really fits the course in terms of the fact that this is a second shot golf course. He's high up there in greens and regulation. He's high in driving accuracy. It's a Donald Ross design here at East Lake, and we know how well he does on Donald Ross courses. Just his record at Sedgefield Country Club for the Wyndham Championship, where he's either winning or he's finishing second or third. So he likes this type of course. So I think he's decent value. And then the guy right behind him, Colin Morikawa, who disappointed last week, even though he played really well on the weekend, he starts at 5 under par, and you can get him around 20 to 1-ish, I think, probably is the market aggregate average. So Morikawa, I think, will fit this better second shot golf course, and only Justin Thomas is better on the tour in strokes gained approach. Those are probably the two best iron players in the game from the fairway, that being JT and Colin Morikawa. Last weekend, he was 9 over par in his first two rounds, but he went 4 under on the weekend. and actually for those two rounds gained like 7.5 strokes gained tee to green on the field. In the first two rounds, I think he lost like close to 5.5 strokes on the field. So he turned it around. He figured it out. I think he'll like this course much better and have a much better approach. So those are the two guys. If I'm going to try to beat the favorites, you can't go too far down the board. So I'm going to go with the number 4 and 5 with Simpson and Morikawa.
You know, one of the guys I talked to a lot, he gave me Webb Simpson as well. First in strokes gained total in the last 50 rounds on par 70 courses, including win at RBC Heritage. So that obviously resonated. The other one he said is Joaquin Niemann. At 150-1, has gained off the tee in 9 of the last 10 events, gained approach on 21 of the last 22 measured events, tied for the second best score last weekend. He went 68 and 67. So I think he's taking a flyer on Niemann. Any thoughts there?
Well, yeah, and Niemann, maybe not for the FedEx Cup market, but if you have a 72-hole market, and I know a lot of the books out here in Las Vegas are not offering that market, but you do have some for our listeners around the country. If you have DraftKings, or if you have FanDuel, or if you have BetRivers, I think there might be one or two others that are offering those markets in terms of just the low 72-hole score. Now, keep in mind, when you're betting into this market, you can still win a bet if you get the low 72-hole score. That doesn't mean you're going to win the Tour Championship, because obviously the staggered strokes are counted. So Niemann, I think, would really fit maybe into that market for low 72 holes. I don't know the price right offhand. It's obviously shorter than the 150-1 you quoted me to win the whole FedEx Cup. But I used a couple guys in that market for the low 72 holes. Daniel Berger is somebody I used. Ranks top 10 in this week's field in driving accuracy and strokes gained off the tee and strokes gained tee to green. And he's been playing, I think, with a little bit of a chip on his shoulder. He doesn't really talk about it much, but if you recall, before we got the restart, Colonial was the first event out of the box where Daniel Berger won the playoff over Morikawa. Before that, he was like just outside the top 100 in the world. So he was not qualified to be in the Masters that they're now going to have in November. And he's still not in the field. So he's just out there, I think, bagging wins, bagging top 5 finishes, bagged another one at the Northern Trust a couple weeks ago where he's third. And look, was right there at the PGA, kind of fell off a little bit on Sunday, but was right in the mix. I think he's going to like this place. It's a very similar layout in ways to TPC Southwind in Memphis, where he's won twice. That was actually the first two wins of his career before the Colonial. So Daniel Berger, I think, fits. Billy Horschel, also 35-1, that'd be the low 72-hole score. Doesn't always make the Tour Championship, but when he does, he goes really well. He won this thing in 2014, was runner-up 2 years ago, seventh in 2013. He had to squeak into this thing, and he almost didn't make the top 30. And the only way he got into the top 30 to advance into this week is when Corey Connors three-putted from 4 feet on the 18th on Sunday. So now that he's survived, he's kind of playing with some house money here in the fact that, hey, I didn't think I was going to be here, and I make it, so I might as well, you know, go all in here and try to win the darn thing. And recall 3 weeks ago, Horschel was second at Sedgefield, which, like I said with Webb Simpson earlier, another Donald Ross design. So Horschel was second at the Wyndham Championship to the Herminator, Jim Herman, the long shot got him, but usually this is the time of year where Horschel's going to play his best golf. Last year, he had 3 top 10s in late July to late September in 2018. Rather, he had 4 top 3 or better finishes during that time frame. So this is kind of that time of year where Billy Horschel gets really hot, late summer, early fall. So he's a guy that could go well and maybe post the low 72-hole score, despite the fact that he's probably not going to win the FedEx Cup starting even par.
Interesting. Okay, I like some of that analysis, or most of it, I should say. But I have another guy who just sent me 5 names, and you know, a couple caught my eye. I'm not thrilled with backing a Finau because it's well documented. I still maintain Shoffley choked with the putter in his hand, but he gave me Finau, Shoffley, Scheffler, Kisner, and Hovland.
All reasonable names. Hovland, obviously, kind of a rookie at this event, as is Scotty Scheffler. Scheffler's been in a little better form lately, but you mentioned Finau, who I also did play for the 72-hole market. I didn't know if we were going to have time to mention him, but he's around 16 to 18 to 1 as well. He shot 5-under on Sunday at Olympia Fields, and it looked like maybe these leaders were going to come back to him, but same old story, same song, different verse with Tony Finau, another top five and not a win, but our mutual friend and one of my broadcast partners, Matt Humans, and I were discussing him this week. We actually have already both bet Tony Finau for the U.S. Open in 2 weeks at Wingfoot, where he's anywhere from 35 to 40 to 1.
Look, all you guys, be my guest. Yeah. I'll let you fire away on him.
Yeah. Well, we've had this discussion. We've discussed this guy so much, so many times, and he leaves us always wanting more, or he always falls short of where we think he should be. But I think when he finally gets a win and he finally gets this monkey off his back, it is going to be a big tournament. I don't know if it's going to be the U.S. Open or it could be this week, but it's not going to be some random, like, boilerplate PGA Tour event like the Greater Milwaukee Open or the John Deere Classic. When he gets in the winner's circle, I think it's going to be a big event.
Okay, if you say so. At some point, I'm done. I'm out, and I've tapped out. So
you love him and you leave him. I guess I'm too loyal here.
Well, it's, you know, I'm going to borrow a phrase from one of my colleagues on Daily Wager. I'd rather be late to the party than early to the party. Like, everyone's right. Trying to predict Belichick to you know, the Patriots' demise this year. Like, okay, fine. And if you all cash tickets, tip of the cap to you, that's fine. But it's just, you're going to make a lot more money not trying to be the first all the time. And obviously you have to beat the market on things. Obviously you have to anticipate and not tail super late. But at some point, it's the definition of insanity, right? But you're right. Like, once you have that breakthrough, like we saw with Mickelson in the majors, they just started coming. So I think if Finau gets over the hump, because we obviously see guys who don't, if he gets over the hump, then I can see it finally, the breakthrough happening. But until then, I'm not chasing it just to say, try to like take away the pain from the earlier backing, if that makes any sense.
No, I totally get it. And look, when, it's like when we bet a team during a season and they let us down so many times, it's like, okay, they're unbettable. You got to put them off the list, because it was almost like when everybody, I understand that analogy, kind of like with the Cleveland Browns a couple of years ago, when all the sharp guys would bet them every single week and use them in the Westgate Super Contest and all of that. And they would find a way to not cover games. Like, they'd be first in goal from the one and need to get it for a backdoor cover, and they wouldn't get in the end.
No, I remember that. That was a Lions game. They threw a pick in the back of the end zone. I remember that.
Yeah, I understand where you're coming from, because, look, we as sports bettors, and we talk about this all the time here on the pod, we are stubborn by nature, mm-hmm. I think. So, and I certainly fall prey to that, and it's something that you always have to monitor and take a self-inventory of as a bettor to – not be too stubborn, but I keep going back for more a little bit. I finally skirted the Ricky Fowler thing after I had put too much money down that hole. He needs to work out the swing changes before I go back to him. But you're absolutely right. At some point, you do reach a breaking point where you're not going to dump money into somebody.
Well, look, I'm not above chasing. I've certainly done that in other situations, and I've known to do a little martingaling here and there, but with this, like, I'm not too pot committed. Like, I've only dipped my toe in a couple times, so I'm okay passing and just, maybe a top 10 finish.
Sometimes the best bet is the one not made.
Yeah, exactly. And then in this point spread world, you save, it's actually, you basically do plus 110 if you don't bet it, versus the direct payout, because you save the dudes. Wes, look, man, great breakdown as always. Really appreciate your insight. It's always fascinating, and you do a wonderful job. And I know our listeners appreciate it. So let's stay hot and finish strong here going into the big grand prize here on the tour.
Doug, it's been great to be on with you all summer talking golf, and hopefully we can keep doing it at some point down the line. But it's been my pleasure being on with you, man.
Yeah, thank you. And hopefully in person once things calm down with the coronavirus and the pandemic. Be well, my friend.
You bet. Take care.
Okay, so a lot of options for you on the golf betting board, thanks to Wes. The Hammer coming up momentarily, but first, if there's a game, someone's betting on it. Stream Better Days, the new Mike Greenberg-hosted series about epic sports betting stories told by the bettors themselves. The series premieres on ESPN Plus today, September 3rd. Stream new episodes every week only on ESPN Plus. Time now to bring in a man who needs no introduction. He is a legend in the betting space and really the broadcasting space. The Hammer, Hank Goldberg. How are you, sir?
I'm good, Doug. It's a very nice morning right so far.
Yeah, I know. This the calendar's turned to September. It's a unique September, to say the least. We have the NBA and NHL playoffs, college football and NFL getting underway. We have the Derby, right?
I think there's five college football games this weekend.
It's a little bit of everything, a hodgepodge of sports. But let's start. I just want to ask you, obviously with the NBA and other sports, there is a difference to players in a bubble. You have the neutral court in the NFL. They're not going to be as many fans. For horses, does the change in the calendar, or more so no fans at Churchill Downs, what impact, if anything, does that have on the horses?
Well, I think the horses are used to running before no fans by now, because they haven't seen any fans since early March, and they've run in a number of stakes races since. So I don't think it's going to bother the horses one way or another. You know, some horses have had difficulty in the gate at Churchill Downs because of the crowd. When they train horses coming up to the Derby prior to this year, they've done a lot of gate work in front of people so that the horses won't get spooked. That's always been a factor. It's not a factor now.
Yeah, so the unknown or the variable that is the Derby race on that Saturday, we don't have. It's going to be what they're already conditioned.
You know what the difference is? You take away 130,000 people, it makes a difference to the jockeys, I'm sure. And, you know, the announcers are going to be the people who are doing the race, with the exception of Kenny Rice. All the other commentators are going to be in a studio in New Jersey.
Right, right. Okay, so let's get to the actual race. Obviously, Tis the Law is the big favorite. A lot of drama with the post, because he was the last name pulled out the other day. So a horse has never won the Kentucky Derby from the 17th position. He is an overwhelming favorite, 3-5 morning line. It's an 18-horse field. How are you playing the Kentucky Derby?
I already won a little bit. I bet that the favorite would be odds on.
Oh, wow.
And it's happened. I think that the post position is going to be a factor in the race, because it creates a dilemma for the jockeys. For example, you've got Authentic, who has John Velasquez, and you've got Honor AP, who has Mike Smith. They're on either side of Tis the Law. Bob Baffert doesn't believe they can beat Tis the Law unless he gets cut off early and has to come from behind, which is something that he has never had to do. He's always been well-placed early. And so this is something that, particularly in the case of Honor AP, who needs to be closer near the front, and the popular thinking is that Velasquez will gun him out of the gate from post 18 so he can get position on the inside, whereas that's not so much the case with Honor AP. But if they decide to play games with Franco, who's inexperienced, at least in the Derby, although he's a leading rider this year nationally, they could want to, you know, do some things to upset him early and take the Tis the Law out of his normal running style. If they do that, though, they're sacrificing their own horses. So this is something the jockeys are going to have to decide. But Baffert, I know, has said that he thinks that's the only way you beat this horse.
So kind of like a coordinated collusion attack, if you will.
That's right. Well, this is a first. You know, I've never seen the top four horses, or I'm throwing New York Traffic in there, but I've never seen my top four horses next to each other in the race.
Okay.
And, you know, I sent Baffert a note, and I said it could be worse. There could be the usual 20 horses, and he'd be outside. Although he won outside 1 year with one of his horses. But, you know, this horse is an exceptional horse. He's won all of his races by 3.5 to 4 lengths.
Okay, so, you know, there's kind of different approaches, obviously, with horse racing. You can try to beat the favorite when you have someone this overwhelming, or you can kind of play with it and try to create a little bit of profits, not just lay a big number on the 3 to 5 or whatever he ends up going off as. How are you betting this year's Kentucky Derby?
Well, there's another horse in here. First of all, the first 9 horses to me. Max Blair, because he has Asmussen, is the only one I took a look at in the top 9 horses. But in 10 through 18, 1,000 words through post 10. This is another Baffert horse. He's got Giroux on him, who, you know, rides this circuit all the time in Churchill. And, you know, he did well in the shared belief. He's a he started off the year kind of slow, but he's really come on lately, and he's training fantastic. The Quakers have watched this horse, and they're very impressed. And he's in a good post 10, for a horse that needs to have a little bit of tactical speed. It's a perfect setup for him. And so I'm going to use him underneath with the my top 4. I think you have to use Authentic. I'll tell you something interesting about Authentic. He barely won the Haskell. He led all the way around. New York Traffic, who has run second now 3 times. He was second in the Haskell, second in the Win, which was in Kentucky. And he was second in the Louisiana Derby, where he got behind a horse that just led wire to wire. But he almost caught Authentic at that race at Monmouth, the Haskell. And in fact, the jockey thought that he had won the race. He had 2 more steps, he would have won. He's trained by a guy named Joseph, who's came over stateside not too long ago from one of the islands. And he has been setting literally records for young trainers. And he knows what he's doing. And this horse has tactical speed. And I think he's going to be a factor in a race. And he's 20-1. So, but Authentic, as I started to say, he was not 100% sharp for the Haskell, but he is 100% sharp right now. You know, you talked about the changes. Baffert had to change, with all his experience, his training methods leading up to this race, because normally he's working towards the first Saturday in May, and now he's working towards the first Saturday in September. So it's a new ball game for him. But Authentic, he says, will run a better race this time. And he's a good horse. Honor AP is a good horse. He's trained by John Sheriff, who had Giacomo, who won this race. He had the great filly, of course, Zenyatta. He knows his way around the track, and I think that horse will run a good race. And the other horse that I'm using, as I said, is 1,000 words. So I'm going to use Tis the Law on top. I just think he's much the best horse. And I'm going to use him in superfectas. I'll use him with one horse in an exacta, and that's New York Traffic. Otherwise, you're not going to get paid very much. So if New York Traffic runs his race, I think he's got a shot to finish second. And he drew a good post. 15 is a good place to be for a horse who runs like that, who really doesn't have much inside him until you get to 1,000 words. So he'll be fine. And, you know, he's Paco Lopez is riding him, and Paco's a heck of a good jockey. And he knows the horse very well. So if I use Tis the Law on top, and I use him with the 15, 16, 18, and 10 underneath, that'll be my superfecta play. And hopefully I'll get New York Traffic is my key. He's got to run second or third for me to get much money.
Okay, that's good stuff. So you're not going to try to beat the favorite, which makes sense given how overwhelming 'Tis the Law has been. And then you're going to try to put some long shots in to create a little nice juice payout. So, and Hank, one more thing. I know you had mentioned the Kentucky Oaks. You have some info on a play.
Well, Gamine, who's Baffert's filly, who he loves, he said if he can't win the Derby, he really wants to go home with the Oaks trophy. But the only horse that can challenge him is Swiss Skydiver, who has four stakes wins in a row. The last horse who beat him was Art Collector, who's male. So I think that's a 1-2 race. You won't make any money. I have one long shot in there who I might throw in as a possibility, and that's number 7. And that's She Shares the Devil. Maybe that's because I'm a Duke Blue Devil that I looked at that horse, but I don't really handicap that way. But that horse, if that horse runs third, you might make a decent trifecta out of that.
Good stuff. Okay, so I appreciate that extra little cherry on top, the extra bonus. Can't argue with that approach at all. So I like it. Hank, it's always, I know we talk a lot on Daily Wager. I know we're going to connect a lot in person once things calm down now that I'm in Las Vegas. I'm very much looking forward to it, my friend. And I know our listeners appreciate your horse racing expertise for this podcast.
Well, you won't have any trouble finding a place to bet in Las Vegas, that's for sure.
Hey, I've never had trouble, right? But no, that's a great point. Hank, thanks so much, and we'll talk soon. Back with our UFC trio here. The gentlemen, Matthew and Lou, guys, we finally did it. We finally put all our heads together and had a very strong card. Kim did not get there in the women's division. She was definitely overmatched from start to finish, all things considered. But Cyphers nearly had it in the first round. We almost had the stoppage and the double whammy inside the distance, but we did get the under plus money and everything else. So, gentlemen, tip of the cap to you. I know our listeners were very appreciative.
Yeah, it was fun. I think we're kind of getting dialed in here and getting a feel of what it means when these fighters fight in the smaller octagon with no fans. And I think the results are starting to show that.
Lou, we appreciated the analysis. And how did you feel after last Saturday? Because it's a big matzo ball out there, as Jerry Seinfeld would say, going on these podcasts. I know it's not the only podcast you go on. You go on the radio, and to put a lot of picks out there, it's never never fun to have a losing night. So it must be great to have a winning night.
It is, and I am not smart enough to be able to dish out various picks to various mediums. So I'm just stupid enough to use the same picks on every venue. And it was a good week last week, but this is what have you done for me lately business. So I'm anxious to see what you and Matthew like as we switch our focus to this week's card.
Yeah, so let's talk about this Labor Day weekend card. It's back at the UFC Apex in Las Vegas. And I just love these kind of matchups in the sport, right? You have this Adonis and Alistair Overeem. We'll start with the main card and the main event. So Overeem in the heavyweight division, just an Adonis and Jack. And then Augusto Sakai, I mean, he's no average dude at the barbecue, but it's just awesome when you get this, this technical sport and you just don't know. But so it's a small favorite, relatively small. Alistair Overeem is at $1.55 here. The total's 1.5. So kind of like we saw last week in the main event, which we were all on the over and that got there. This one is juiced -185 for a 5-round bout. We've talked about guys starting slowly. Matthew, you said fighters tend to pace themselves, even in the smaller octagon. Are you looking at the over here? Do you have a pick on the side?
Yeah, I do like the over here. I think a lot of things have changed. So Alistair Overeem is 3-1 since making the move to Elevation Fight Team with wins over Walt Harris, Alexei Olenek, Sergey Pavlik, Fabricio Verdum lately. But the problem is most of those wins, other than the Walt Harris one, have come against guys that are later in their career. And what we've seen from Overeem since he made that move to Elevation Fight Team is a much more patient fighter. You know, the one loss was to Rosenstruck since he made that move, and that loss came in a fight that he was winning, about to win a decision, and 5 seconds left in the fight, got caught with that huge right hand that split his mouth wide open, and it was kind of a quick stoppage. But besides that, what we've seen is a very patient Alistair Overeem. I mean, he got in trouble in the first round against Walt Harris, big time trouble there, was able to stay calm, stay patient, weather the storm, come back and get the finish late in the second. And I think because of that, we're probably going to see a fight where Augusto Sakai is sort of a plodding heavyweight, does have some power, 5-0 in the UFC, three of those wins coming by knockout. But what we saw in fights against Blagoy Ivanov and Andrei Arlovsky is if you come out and set a slow pace against Sakai, he tends to adhere to that same slow pace. Alistair Overeem, a slow starter. I think this one gets 7.5 minutes at least.
Well, what do you think about that?
As I assess the fight, I think I'll answer that question, Doug, by taking a side on this fight, and the side I'll take is Overeem. He opens in this fight minus 215. And I think based on, I'm going to call him Sakai, but I don't know how to pronounce his last name, Saki or Sakai, his four UFC opponents, Ivanov, Arlovsky, Tybura, Sherman, totally one-dimensional, slow-paced strikers that are right there for him. He's going to be, by about 10 years, the younger man. However, Overeem will be an inch taller. He's going to have about a 3-inch reach advantage, arms and 2 inches legs. And we know that in stand-up fights, fighters with height and reach benefit 60% of the time. I see this as being totally a stand-up fight. Sakai has never given a glimpse as to any kind of grappling. He's really a Muay Thai-based fighter from Brazil, and none of his opponents, shallow as their talent is, has ever tested him on the ground. I look for Overeem to be very dominant in this fight. I look for him to use the patience and distance and movement that's made him such a great fighter as well. We can't forget, Overeem's been fighting 20 years. In his 46 wins, he has 24 by knockout, 17 by submission. That leaves only 5 decisions in 20 years. I think Overeem's too much for Sakai, and over the course of time, I think he's going to eventually finish him. But Sakai is a big, strong, 265-pound, 29-year-old heavyweight who is talented. And so I do believe, and I agree with Matthew on the over, it's going to take Overeem some time to chop this man down. And I do believe come the third or fourth round, that's when he'll do it.
Why do you think the numbers come down from minus 215?
Because I think people have watched Sakai look impressive against Cannes. They're looking at his 4-0 record, and all they remember from Overeem is that he has a weak chin. But I will say this, and part of the assist goes to the referee in Overeem's last fight against Walt Harris, but Sakai doesn't hit harder than Walt Harris, and Walt Harris hit Overeem with a flush shot that Overeem survived. So I'm less concerned about Overeem's chin because I'm that much confident in his athleticism and movement.
Yeah. Okay. Solid breakdown across the board for that as well. Much lower favorite here with Alonzo Menifield against OSP. And Matthew, I believe you both have plays on this, but we have a couple guys who look like Adonises here. So it's a more of a conventional matchup in terms of physique here. But OSP's the dog here, Matthew.
Yeah, I certainly understand why Lou might be leaning toward OSP here. I also lean toward that, but I made a wager on the over 1.5 rounds here. We saw Alonzo Menifield that throughout his career is kind of a big, huge, really muscular guy who tends to get early knockouts, and when he doesn't, really struggles. But OSP is a tough guy to knock out. This is a guy who's been in there with the Corey Andersons, the Yair Latifis, the Dominic Reyes, the John Jones. He fought Ben Rothwell at heavyweight in his last fight. Only one of OSP's last 10 fights, period, have ended in a knockout either way. He's a guy who tends to be in there until the very end. So this is a guy that's really hard to knock out. And on the other side, Alonzo Menifield, as we saw in his last fight against Devin Clark, really struggles when he can't get the knockout. He doesn't have an offensive wrestling game. He doesn't really have a submission game. This is a bulked up, guy who really is dependent on his power early and his athleticism to be able to get people out of there. What we saw is when he stepped up his competition against a versatile fighter, that just wasn't able to work. I think this fight's going to come out fast. Menefield will come out fast in this fight. OSP is going to be the bigger guy, the proven guy. He's been in there with plenty of guys that hit harder, or at least as hard as Menefield. He'll be able to weather the storms early. And I think through the course of this one, this fight's going to dramatically slow down after the first round, and we're going to see a plodding pace in rounds 2 and 3 like we did in the last fights for both guys, including that Menefield fight against Devin Clark. I know, again, it's dangerous betting unders with these big guys in the UFC, but OSP, again, he just doesn't get knocked out. Only one of his last 10 fights ending in knockout. I think we definitely get 7.5 minutes here, and we only have to lay 125.
Lou, what do you think?
I really think that Matthew covered that fight very well. I totally agree that provided I can determine through interviews today and tomorrow that the fighters provide media outlets, that St. Preux has had no interruption in his camp for the last 2 weeks since this was postponed, I'm of the opinion that he should be the favorite in this fight. Again, another stand-up fight. Menefield does not wrestle. If this fight goes to the floor, not only will St. Preux have advantage, but he could liable to stop the fight. But that fight won't get to the floor till the second or third round, because Menefield's going to come out on fire in that first. So I believe St. Preux has to weather a frantic first round and then use his experience, his height, and his reach. Again, 3 inches the taller man, 4 inches a reach advantage. On the feet, St. Preux will have advantage just long enough to tire this monster out, then get him to the floor. I'll go with St. Preux plus the 110 on this, but totally agree with Matthew's breakdown of the over as well.
So you'll take a little bit of value, a guy who should be favored, so you're catching plus 110. And look, what does that say? Scared money doesn't get paid, or whatever that phrase is. You just can't be afraid to lose, right? Like, if there is a chance Menefield comes out like he usually does and just gets after his opponent and the fight ends relatively early, and then we would lose the over bet. But you're, in terms of, like, you know, they say this in a lot of the math guys, like if they played this 1,000 times, this is the outcome. I mean, like, of course there is a percentage of that, but you just like the value of the over 1.5 in terms of just the frequency it would happen if they face each other 1,030. So that's the thought process on that. Now, the card has changed a little bit. You guys alluded to that a little bit, but I do want to talk about the first female fight. We had a bunch of heavy favorites in the women's division last weekend. This one with Carol Rosa is a little more tolerable in terms of the price, if you will. It's a minus -135 over Eubanks. Either of you have a play on this?
Go ahead, Lou.
Yeah, I would say that it's not often that I'm going to favor the older fighter, especially in a woman's fight, but I'm not convinced of Carol Rosa, who just in a couple of UFC fights against nominal competition, she has won her fights, but she allows 7 strikes to be landed on her per minute, even though her output is high. Ciara Eubanks is a little bit more evenly based. She's a grinder. She's a pressure fighter. Strikes at 5 strikes landed per minute and only allows 3.3. And she has 66% takedown defense. I believe that Eubanks has been fighting fighters a level up from Rosa. And I don't know that it's a full release for me, but I lean Ciara Eubanks based on experience and body of competition against Carol Rosa.
Okay. I can get behind that.
Yeah, I actually, you know, in this fight, I didn't play it. I passed on this fight because I made a big, big bet on Carol Rosa. I mean, on Carol Rosa in her last fight against Vanessa Mello, where I thought she just enjoyed too much a size advantage, athleticism advantage, and she absolutely dominated Vanessa Mello in that fight is a pretty significant favorite. And while I know she's only 25 and she is really raw, and she even showed it in that Mello fight again that she was raw and she was hittable. And I certainly, you know, had she been the underdog here, I would have played in it. But I also think that Carol Rosa is so talented, and she trains at one of those gyms in Brazil, that Vale Tudo gym that has like 100 fighters that are professionals there. So she has great sparring partners, great trainers. She's so talented. You know, Eubanks may get her in this spot because, again, she's still really raw at 25 years old, and she showed some of that, those holes in her game last fight, but she is really talented. And I think you're going to see Carol Rosa at some point as a top 10, top 8 fighter. And thus, you know, when you see people that talented, I always wonder, when are they going to put it all together? They could do it any time. And she started to put it all together in that last fight against, obviously, a much lesser opponent than she'll face here. But for that reason, I had to pass.
Okay, fair enough. And you also have a little special place in your heart for Rosa, given the big wager you won. We all have that. And he's all the sports, like, we all have that team that we just like to bet on, and or at least we had a big bet where they rewarded you. I mean, there's times where I've been at a nightclub in Vegas, like, you know, somehow felt compelled to tell someone. Like GSP, I was actually at a media event a long time ago. This was when he was underpriced, and he was like -$2 against Matt Hughes, and Matt Hughes was basically like the end of his career, last fight, and GSP just sat on him for 3 rounds. It was the most dominating performance. And I told him, like, I won a bunch of money on you, like, that the following Monday. He goes, oh, thank you. You're very welcome. Because GSP is, like, the most honorable, polite person that there ever was, walked the face of the earth. So it was just funny that you feel that you have such a special attachment to these people. So I respect your apprehension to fade Rosa, given how much she has rewarded you. We're keeping it on the main card. Someone has a play on the Turner fight. I think it's you, Matthew. Is that right?
Yes. So, I have a couple more main card plays. And the first one is Jalen Turner here, +160. And I also like the over in this fight. It's sort of like the Hannah Cyphers fight from last week, where we tried to hit both the dog and the under, both at big pluses, over 200 on both sides. Here we're going to take Turner +160 and over 2.5 rounds +125. And this is a fight where I played against Moses in his last fight against Michael Johnson, and he was getting lit up in that first round. In fact, there was a chance that they almost could have stopped that fight at the end of the first, because Michael Johnson was starting to land some big punches at the end of that first round. And Thiago Moses literally had no answer at all for Michael Johnson on the feet. And if you remember in that fight, literally to start the second round, Moses dove across the octagon, got a hold of Michael Johnson's ankle. Michael Johnson, unfortunately, has zero ground game and ended up getting submitted there. On the ground, but it showed that Thiago Moses still hasn't become a well-rounded fighter, and that his stand-up game just is not there at all yet. And what I like about this fight is Jalen Turner has never been submitted. Now, he doesn't have the biggest sample size, 14 professional fights, but still, in all three of his UFC wins come by knockout, Jalen Turner. What is the kryptonite for Thiago Moses? It's the stand-up game. So I think, you know, that there's a place here where Moses doesn't have to win this by knockout. He can just keep the fight standing. He's probably going to dominate. And on the other side, the one thing Moses showed off in that Michael Johnson fight was a pretty good chin. He took some big shots from a hard puncher in Michael Johnson. He has never been stopped. All four losses for Thiago Moses are by decision. He's never been stopped. So at the end of the day, there's a pretty good chance for Turner that even if he's winning the stand-up, he's not going to knock Moses out, who's shown his toughness. So I like Turner +160 since he's never been submitted. And that seems to be the only path to victory for Thiago Moses here, is either to submit Turner or at least, you know, keep him down for 3 rounds. For Turner, it seems like a pretty easy path to victory. Avoid that submission, avoid that takedown, keep the fight standing, and he should be able to cruise here. So I'm taking +160 on Jalen Turner, over 2.5 rounds, +125.
Okay, Lou, do you have anything to add there?
Yeah, I do like Turner. I wrote an article earlier in the week about this fight just being so stylistically fantastic, just for the reasons Matthew just enumerated. Moises is going to be out of his league on the feet as much as Jalen Turner will be out of his league on the floor, although Turner has enough wrestling acumen to utilize his takedown defense to keep Moises off of him, and that'll be the key to the fight. I have less feel for the total, but I do like Jalen Turner.
Makes sense. All right. Matthew, you mentioned you had another play on the main card. What was that?
So I like Michael Pereira, -115 against Zalim Amediev. And I think this is an interesting fight where Pereira is getting massively undervalued because of some of his crazy losses on his resume. He has some of the most crazy endings in fights. He had a disqualification loss against Diego Sanchez in his last fight for an illegal knee. He actually had a disqualification loss and turned into a no contest for missing weight in a Heat FC competition. He had another no contest in the Heat organization for getting his foot injured by the cage. It got stuck in a cage and got injured, and they had to stop the fight because of that. And he had a flying knee KO in his last fight against Danny Roberts. I mean, this guy just has unbelievable, crazy endings to his fight, but he also has a lot of experience. This is a guy who knocked out Danny Roberts, who's been in there with some legit guys, who comes from a great gym, who has big-time power with double-digit knockouts. And on the other side, Amediev is one of those guys. All but one of his fights came in the same regional scene, I think, in Russia. You know, he was 8-0 entering the UFC, came over from Russia. He's had two UFC fights, and he lost them both, and he got blasted by Danny Roberts. And again, I always like that recent fight where each guy fought the same guy recently. So Amediev fought Danny Roberts in his last fight and got knocked out in the first round. Pereira fought Danny Roberts two fights ago and knocked out Danny Roberts. So, I mean, this is a situation where Amediev has looked a little bit overmatched since, you know, coming over from the Russian regional scene. And Pereira, although he's a little bit of a wild man in there, and that can lead to some, you know, unforeseen results, albeit could it be a disqualification or point deductions because he does get a little bit wild in the octagon. I think just from a skill set, a level of competition basis, and the proven ability to compete with major UFC talent, Michael Pereira certainly is ahead in all of those categories, and this fight's essentially a pick 'em. So I'm taking Michael Pereira, -115.
Great. Lou, do you have anything on that?
Two guys that are 0-2 their last two fights, and I think what you're going to find here is maybe one of the best fights of the night because there's desperation with each guy. This is Pereira's last fight on his current contract, and for that reason, I give him a little bit of a lean to be a little bit more focused than the Russian, who I found to be maybe not deserving of being in the UFC.
Interesting. Okay, so possibly a lot of value there, -115. Lou, anything left on this main card before we get to the prelims?
No, I'm covered.
Okay, Matthew, we're good?
Yep.
All right, so let's go to the prelims, Lou. I know there's been some shuffling here. What, if I remember correctly, you like the first one, Cole Smith and Azur.
Yes. Here's a fight, a fighter in Hunter Azur that fought about 8 weeks ago, and he fought Brian Kelleher, who's also on this card. In that fight, Azur had his wife had delivered a baby 2 weeks earlier, and he's a natural bantamweight that took the fight with Kelleher at 145. He looked outstanding for a round and a half, but he came out and he just spent himself. He ran out of gas, and Kelleher finished him. So we're going to get a really dynamic wrestling-based fighter that's polished and striking off a loss, coming in against a guy in Cole Smith who lost his last fight, which was back in 2019. Now, I'm not worried that he was fighting injury. He's been trying to get better. Cole Smith has got a black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and he's been out to Phuket to train on Muay Thai. But he's a real tall drink of water. He's 5'11 and is going to only have a 67-inch reach. Azur, 5'8 with a 71-inch reach. So no real advantage in the stand-up, but it's Azur's wrestling in this fight that's going to cause Smith some problems. And Smith, on occasion, has relied between his rubber guard and his length. He's a little too comfortable on the back on the floor practicing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and a world-class wrestler, and Azur is a top-end college championship wrestler from Montana State. Wrestling can often be the kryptonite for Brazilian jiu-jitsu. This is going to be a really competitive, tight fight, but Hunter Azur will get his hand raised. And it's a fight I released earlier in the week, Azur minus 187. If you're shopping for him now, he's maybe 200 or 210. And I try and do that when I know a fighter is going to offer value early in the week. I try and release him early for people that follow me on Twitter to try and take advantage of that. But Hunter Azur, no matter which way you cut it, I like him in this fight.
And first off, Lou, dead on that line move. It certainly, I'm seeing 220s even now and a couple of 230s pop up. So you certainly had it pegged where the money was going to go on that fight. And I jumped on with you early in the week. My only nervousness or hesitation now about this one is, I thought that Hunter Azor was winning the stand-up fight against Brian Kelleher till he got caught with that big punch. And I think that he could dominate Cole Smith here. And Hunter Azor, throughout his brief career, whatever, we have 9 or 10 fights, has shown a little bit of a tendency to fade late. And nothing tires these guys out like wrestling. So what I'd like to see him do in this fight really is use that same quality, crisp stand-up game that we saw against Brian Kelleher, a much more established guy, and go out there, and because I think Cole Smith will have a really hard time competing on the feet with Azor, and then maybe that won't tire him out as much either. I worry about them getting into these elongated grappling exchanges and what it may do to the gas tank of Hunter Azor, or even giving Cole Smith a chance to catch something off his back. I think if they stand up, though, I don't see how Hunter Azor loses the fight, even as the shorter guy.
All right, so come out of the gates firing, laying about $2. You guys got a better number, but our listeners, I like that style. Set the tone for the fight. Go in big and then go from there. Matthew, any prelims on your card?
Yeah, I like Alexander Romanov, and I almost – it's a big heavyweight matchup, Alexander Romanov, Marcos Rogério de Lima, and I almost never end up on guys making their UFC debut because we have seen so many of them sort of wilt under the bright lights. And I also don't love betting on some of these fighters making their UFC debut who don't necessarily have athletic-looking bodies, and Romanov certainly fits that. He's a little bit pudgy around the waist. And he hasn't fought since February of 19. So I was a lot of hesitancies, but as I looked at this matchup more and more and more, Rogério de Lima is a guy that fought most of his career at 205, fighting guys like Ovin St. Peru and Nikita Krylov, and he fought some pretty tough guys at light heavyweight. He made the move to heavyweight, and suddenly it hasn't been an athletic move to heavyweight, let's put it that way. Rogério de Lima doesn't look good physically at heavyweight. He's a little bit pudgy. He may have faster hands in this fight. What I really like here is Romanov's ability as a heavyweight, because we don't see a lot of heavyweights that are able to, A, score takedowns consistently, and then get finishes on the ground consistently, and Romanov is one of those guys. In fact, several of his knockouts have come from ground and pound on the ground. He is just consistently able to get fights to the ground, and I think that's going to be a big-time problem for the much smaller Rogério de Lima, who's making the move up. I mean, he's a career 205er who's now 35 years old, and he's had problems before. Four of his 6 losses are by submission. So we're talking about strength versus weakness again. Romanov's strength, the ground game. Rogério de Lima's weakness, the ground game, where he's been submitted several times before. I'm going to go with the UFC newcomer laying a very small minus 120 price to get the submission win against Marcus Rogério de Lima.
Lou, do you have anything on that fight?
Just that Romanov has got sumo in his background, ooh, which is fascinating. And that complements Matthew's lean to how strong he'll be if he gets this to the ground, and Rogério being a smaller man. I'll say that I think Rogério de Lima is stout enough and durable enough that I'm looking at a plus price as the over 1.5 here. This thing after a round could get to be looking an awful lot like a slow dance at the prom, two guys leaning on each other. And so for that reason, I'm going to tell you that I like the over 1.5 at plus money a little bit.
I like that. You didn't have to go to the flyweight division for that one. You went to the heavyweight. It's good. Slow dance at the prom. So well done there with the sumo wrestler involved. Well, there's only two other cards on the prelims. Anything we got on these two guys?
I got Fabinski and Muniz under 2.5 rounds plus 150. And I think this is one of those situations, again, where maybe sometimes the octagon, the shorter octagon at the UFC Apex, helps these guys in a strength versus weakness battle on both sides. You know, all four of Muniz's losses are by KO. I mean, he is really chinny. This is a guy who doesn't do well in the stand-up and tends to get finished. Fabinski, on the other side, 4-1 in the UFC with 8 wins by knockout in his career. This is a guy who wants to keep it standing and can bang. And on the other side, Muniz, 12-19 wins by submission. He's a Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt who's a dynamo on the ground. And Fabinski's last loss in the UFC, a submission loss to Michael Prezeres, a very similar fighter to Muniz, although Prezeres probably being much more accomplished than Muniz at this point. But I think it's one of those fights where if it goes to the ground, there's a very good chance Muniz gets the submission. If they stay standing, history's shown us Muniz has a really hard time. He's been knocked out 4 times by strikers. And we have the 25-foot smaller octagon here, and plus 250 on under 2.5 rounds. I went under 2.5 rounds and took the plus 1.5.
Wow, that does sound great. Why do you think the juice is so heavy on the over?
I tend to find that the opening odds on these cards that are sort, you know, some of these fights that are sort of obscure, that they always overvalue the over on women's fights and guys that are just at the lighter weights.
Lou, anything else?
No, I think Matthew did a great breakdown of that, and I'm liable to tail him on that. I read them loud and clear and love it.
Yeah, I always pride myself on being able to sort of see where the wind's blowing, read between the lines on people's analysis, whether it be listening to the radio, I aggregate information. And this certainly sounds like maybe my favorite play on the card. So well done, Matthew. If nothing else, you're very, you have a bright future in sales. So well done. Well done on that. Hey, gentlemen, honestly, really appreciate all your work. Thank you so much. We did well last card. Let's stay hot. Have a fun holiday weekend as much as you can during this current climate. And we got NFL next week, college football this weekend, the bubble for both the NBA and NHL. We got the Kentucky Derby. It's a wild September, early September. And so we're having a lot of fun, but let's not sleep on the potential winners in the octagon. So thanks to both of you.
Thanks, guys. Best of luck this weekend. Take care.
Okay, a lot of winners with Matthew and Lou, especially that last one, the over plus 250. I'm going to jump in on that as soon as we are done taping, and then hopefully a lot of winners as well with Hank and Wes. He's been quite the golf predictor this summer, so good to get him on and have him nail a bunch of picks. Christina, thanks to you as always. Thanks to everyone listening for a safe holiday weekend. And again, look for NFL content next week leading up to the season that will be unprecedented, right? We say that around, I'll throw that around, but look, we know the fans, the stadiums won't be packed. It's a unique season to say the least. We don't have preseason games. All these coaches are being super secretive with reporters getting suspended and whatnot. So it's going to be an interesting breakdown next week when we look ahead to the upcoming NFL season. Until then, have a great weekend.